Yeah, it did. I mean, there's something about the college game, and I write about this in the book too. I mean, the games themselves are kind of defined in when they're played, right? So like the high school Friday Night Lights has this sort of real release, end of the week kind of deal. The NFL is on Sunday, which is can be a little bit of a bleak day. Oh my God, I got work on Monday, you know, kind of thing. So you're kind of just lounging around the couch. But Saturday is this incredible. I mean, college games are on the best day of the weekend, right?
You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
Today we're heading back into the wild heart of college football in the early 2000s, joined by Monty Burke, New York Times bestselling author of Men of Troy, The Epic Afternoons, Wild Nights, and Enduring Legacy of Pete Carroll's USC Trojans, and that's from Grand Central Publishing, out January 13th, 2026. We get into how a so-called failed NFL coach turned USC into a Hollywood-sized dynasty, and how it all came crashing down. Before we dive in, if you're a writer or creator who wants to build a real business of your own around your newsletter, head over to O'LearyWriters.com, where you can grab my Substack Success Blueprint. It's a 31-page, no-fluff guide to growing your list and turning it into a sustainable, profitable publication. And without further ado, here's our interview with Monty Burke. All right, today we have Monty Burke with us. He recently released a book called Men of Troy, The Epic Afternoons, Wild Nights, and Enduring Legacy of Pete Carroll's USC Trojans. And it was published by Grand Central Publishing January 13th, 2026, last week, as we're talking here. So Monty also wrote Saban, Making of a Coach, released in 2016, written several books and innumerable essays about fly fishing. And as I was telling Monty a second ago, I'm a big college football fan and a former professional in the fly fishing industry in a former life. So we have a lot of common interests. But today we're here to talk about Men of Troy. Monty, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. First of all, I wanted to just talk about folks who haven't read perhaps some of your other works and your full story and where you grew up.
I grew up kind of all over the place. I mean, I was born in the Northeast, but the majority of my childhood was in Alabama. So, I actually was lucky enough. The Crimson Tide used to play in Birmingham, which is where I lived. And my grandfather was a drinking buddy of Bear Bryant's, which was not a unique designation in Alabama at that time. So I would go to, you know, games at Legion Field and saw, you know, Alabama, Notre Dame, Alabama, Kentucky, all these great games. So that really got me into college football. I just, from that point on, have been eaten up with college football.
Okay. And so it was mostly Alabama, and you had somewhat itinerant childhood, but so moving around mold you in any way, college football?
Yeah, I mean, what's funny is the Northeast doesn't have a very good college football heritage.
Hang on. I went to Boston College.
Except so, for, I was about to say.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, all right.
Literally, it's except for Boston College. It's so funny. I mean, you know, it does way back in the day, right? If you go all the way.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're sort of the, you know, that was the pinnacle of the sport way back in the day. But, and one thing that was kind of fun in Men of Troy, I spend a little time in one chapter talking about the sort of how college football started. And it did start here in the Northeast and started with Princeton and Rutgers with the first game. And then, you know, it kind of went down south, and then it had its own sort of manifest destiny. You know, it went out west, and the sort of anchor school out west was USC. But just, you know, in terms of childhood, you know, I was kind of more of an NFL nut when I was up here being the Northeast. And then, you know, down south, people don't, in Alabama particularly, they don't care much. I mean, they'd still like pro football, but it's all about the Crimson Tide and all about the Auburn Tigers. You know, I mean, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I have family down there. And yeah, it's, you know, until what? The 90s, there was the Falcons was the only school, or maybe the Redskins, if you identified them as a team of the South. But
it's bizarre because Atlanta's only 2 hours away from Birmingham, so you would think there'd be more Falcons fans there. I found there to be more Steelers fans there. It was a steel town like Pittsburgh was, so I think there's a lot of transplants and a lot of heritage there. But you know, so interesting. But it's all about the Tide, really.
Yeah. And then you mentioned you grew up in Vermont, ended up at Middlebury College, and did you be do you want to become a writer then or not?
I did. I really did. I mean, I didn't have necessarily the cojones to kind of follow that path right away, but it took me a couple of years, but I did absolutely always want to be a writer. I always loved three things I think were kind of preeminent in my life was, fly fishing, football, and writing, and writing slash reading. Put that in one category.
Yeah. And I think maybe we can talk about fly fishing and another day. I want to talk again, Men of Troy here today, but so college football sounds like it became an obsession or at least a major interest as a child.
Yep. Yeah, it did. I mean, there's something about the college game, and I write about this in the book too. I mean, the games themselves are kind of defined in when they're played, right? So like the high school Friday Night Lights has this sort of real release, end of the week kind of deal. The NFL is on Sunday, which is can be a little bit of a bleak day. Oh my God, I got work on Monday, kind of thing. So you're kind of just lounging around the couch. But Saturday is this incredible. I mean, college games are on the best day of the weekend, right? You have a day of recovery on the other side of it. You have students at the game. You have bands. You have alums coming back to the place where they probably spent the best 4 years of their lives. So there's this incredible atmosphere to college games, even when you're, especially when they're stadium, but even on TV, there's like a different, orally, so sound wise, it's very different. It's got always has the bands, and they always like, pan to the student section. Students seem to be more emotive than, NFL fans. They're like, they're biting on their fingernails, and they're kind of hanging on every play. So always, that to me has always been really fascinating how different the games are kind of depend on when they're played.
Yeah. And, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and, we had the Oregon Ducks and the Oregon State Beavers, but in the 80s, those teams were awful. They were awful. And we followed, or at least I did, Division II Portland State Vikings, who were, great. And so the whole idea of college football and going to that stadium was raucous. You go down to Eugene or Corvallis, and it was gloomy and dismal. We watched on Saturday. They always had the big games. So, of course, USC, Notre Dame, Penn State, the aforementioned Boston College, not on TV too much, but they had a Heisman Trophy winner that took Alabama to the woodshed at one point.
They were in that awesome game against Miami, that's for sure. I remember watching that.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah. You wrote a biography about 10 years ago about Nick Saban. And this was, more of a biography than this book you have right now. The book you have out, Men of Troy, right now is really a snapshot. It is somewhat a biography of Pete Carroll, but it's really a snapshot of the period when Pete Carroll was at UC. So I think I want to ask, what is it about these coaches or coaches in general that keep pulling you back to these biographical sketches or even total projects?
So again, I love college football, but to me, college football coaches are some of the most interesting kind of figures in American society, right? I mean, they have to be so many different things at once. They, have to be great recruiters. They have to be sort of psychologists. They have to be teachers. They're sort of like military leaders. They're the bigger programs, they're media celebrities. And, college football coaches have to speak to the media, unlike the CEO of JP Morgan, these guys are during the season are talking to the media. They're very accountable, right? 3 or 4 times a week. They're in front of the media answering questions. So, they're basically CEOs of medium-sized companies. So, and also in college football, they have a lot more control than they do than the typical coach in the NFL. I mean, they are kind of the functioning GM as well. These guys have always interested me and the obsession that they have for the game and for the little meticulous details that go into, creating a great team and creating a great staff and player development, all that sort of stuff is always just truly, truly fascinating me. And the cool thing about Pete Carroll's that era, that 9-year era, which really they haven't, it still endures to this day, really, because they haven't really recovered from the sanctions that happened at the end of it. But that 9-year era, college football is for the most part a game of small towns, smallish towns, small to medium towns, we call them, Tuscaloosa, State College, with the exception of Boston College and Miami, stuff like that. There are not many that are in cities, right? And USC was at that time, during that era, was in Los Angeles. and there were no NFL teams there. So they were the only NFL thing in town, or the only football kind of game in town, and that, aside from UCLA, but they started winning and they attracted all these, you know, celebrities and business people from LA, which who love winners, right? They're totally attracted to winners. And, you know, you had people like Snoop Dogg and Will Ferrell and the Fonz and Arnold, you know, like not just going to games. These guys practice, you know, it was like so crazy. I was talking to this, I interviewed this punter.
Which is no longer allowed after reading toward the end of your book, or maybe it is again.
Yeah, they don't allow it. And most coaches don't want, what was interesting about Carroll, he didn't care. He didn't care if a scout from the other team was there. He's like, we're going to beat you anyway. You can know all our plays. It doesn't really matter. And he was right for a long period there, for they won 34 games in a row. But, you know, it just was so interesting. I mean, I was interviewing this the punter, and he talked about, like, you know, practicing his punts and looking over like 3 feet away from him, and there was Snoop Dogg standing there. So it became this kind of like crazy vibe thing that was going on. And of course it became an incredible recruiting advantage. A couple of the guys I talked to said, you know, I went to to go visit the campus on my recruiting visit, and I met Snoop Dogg, and, like, you know, you're probably going to go to USC if Snoop Dogg comes and gives you a high five, you know, during your recruiting visit. So it just was this era. I felt like, you know, then the NFL teams came back, and it just was this era. I think that it never happened before where a team had, like, totally captured a city that size, and will never happen again because of the sanctions, because of the way the college football is now, because they have two teams there now. I mean, you know, two NFL teams there now. So to me, that was what's kind of fascinating about that 1 9-year stretch there.
Yeah. Unique time in college football for sure. So USC, let's, for everybody who is listening, or they should know that what USC has been a national power for well over a century. And there were some downtimes for sure that you mentioned in the book, but really with John McKay, they built this program back up in the 70s. McKay ends up going to the Buccaneers, you know, so on and so forth. But then John Robinson comes in, seamless transition, and they win three national titles in the 70s. And Robinson then goes to the Rams, also in LA at the time. And USC was competitive. They were good. They weren't great until Carroll's second year came around, really. You talk about right at that transition when USC started winning these national titles. 72, I think, was the first one in that era. You talk about the modern age of football starts in 1970. I was interested in that. Well, how did you determine that as the delineation point of the modern era? Is it the 100 years after that first Princeton game?
You know, it's interesting that is, I don't remember the exact source on that, but that is a widely accepted thing that the modern era of college football started basically in 1970. It had something to do with the formation of the conferences, you know, television deals, scholarships too. They went, I believe that was the year they went from, like, you know, unlimited to they had some sort of limit on them, stuff like that. It was like kind of the formation of the NCAA kind of.
Okay, so it's not the play of the game, but it's all the machinations of how it's structured and how. Yeah, okay. I was wondering about that because forward pass was around 1970. We know, yeah. You know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so we get in this era. You know, you talk about the unlimited scholarships, and, you know, USC being this, or in LA and having all the glitz and glamour of LA. And then one of the themes throughout the book is amateurism and what college football is. So my contention is that college football has never really been an amateur sport, so-called. It has, the NCAA came in, 1906, 1905, somewhere in there, and established all these rules for eligibility for these players. But it's never been particularly amateur as the old Olympic standard or AAU standard might have been, because these players had scholarships and, you know, we all know they were, you know, a lot of them are getting paid somewhat. But you want to talk a little bit about the amateurism?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so to me, the most interesting thing, I mean, so you're right that they, you know, they had scholarships, they had free room and board, they, you know, got a free ride to college, you know, which is a big deal. I have two kids in college. Love to have that right now. And then they had a stipend, which was about $800, you know, depending on what year, was about $800 a month. However, you got to look at a guy, and, you know, I get deeply into the scandal towards the end of the book, the Reggie Bush scandal. Look at a guy like Reggie Bush. And this is where the amateurism model really falls apart. Who was the best player in college football for 2 years. One of the best players of all time, really, in college football. If you think about it, a true triple threat, you know, like great running back, incredible receiver, and incredible returner of kicks. And, you know, this guy just was electric. He set the whole city on fire, right? And USC, he was making the university gobs of money. He was making the NCAA gobs of money. He was making the NCAA's broadcast partners gobs of money. And yet legally, he couldn't cash in on that. And so, you know, he got caught up on it because he, you know, allegedly went out and tried to do it the other way, you know, tried to do it under the table. And so I do think that that scandal actually resonates and it precipitates in a way the changes that we have now in college football. You know, the ability for these athletes to kind of, you know, cash in on their names, images, and likenesses, and, you know, not necessarily the transfer portal, but certainly the NIL stuff. And, you know, to me, that was the first time, I think, especially when the NCAA came down, if you remember the, you know, there was the Reggie Bush, the huge scandal, and Yahoo covered it, and all the newspapers got all over it, ESPN was all over it. And then, you know, the NCAA came down really, really hard on USC. Not quite the death penalty that SMU got, but certainly harder than later scandals like at Penn State, which is a horrible scandal. And then at Miami, Ben Shapiro, also a horrible scandal, way harder than those guys. They basically, USC has never really recovered. I'll put it that way. You know, they lost many scholarships. They couldn't go to bowl games. They haven't quite been nationally relevant since then. And I think, you know, the scales kind of drop from people's eyes at this point. Like, why? Wait a minute. You know, like what right do we have to tell these kids that they, you know, kids up at, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is creating Facebook at Harvard, he gets to keep all the money, whatever he does there, right? And so, you know, it's just really interesting to me. I feel like that precipitated what we have now in college football, for better or for worse.
Yeah, you mentioned SMU, and they did get the death penalty. You talk about going back, you know, Eric Dickerson, somehow his grandma buys him a Trans Am. You know, that's a famous story, and he won't talk about it to this day. My contention is that some of these guys started talking too much and complaining too much about not getting their bag, and that more or less ruined it. You know, so getting back to SMU, you know, with Eric Dickerson and Craig James and all those guys, they were, you know, they were one of the top teams, not quite as successful as USC at this point, but they left a couple years later. Their program goes on the death penalty. And as you mentioned in the book, the sanctions that the NCAA imposes doesn't affect these guys that took all the money. Doesn't affect the coaches that can move on. It affects the next level of kids. And then the whole alumni base or the fan base of these schools get torched because they didn't catch it in time, or they penalized too. I don't know the answer, but you do mention that.
One of the most poignant interviews I had in there was with Matt Barkley, who was the Carroll's last quarterback, you know, freshman phenom. You know, had to start. Mark Sanchez left early for the draft, so he had to start Carroll's last year. You know, played well, didn't play great, but ended up being, you know, one of the greatest USC quarterbacks of all time. But he, you know, he was there when the sanctions came down. And, you know, he talked about how difficult it was, you know, and how he had nothing to do with it. He and the other 75 guys on the team, 85 guys on the team, 84 guys on the team, whatever, had nothing to do with that scandal, zero to do with it. And they had to deal with it. So they had to deal with not being able to go to bowl games, you know, literally using walk-ons, you know, sometimes in the starting lineup, but you know, their whole, there was no depth, right? Every second stringer was some walk-on kid who just happened, oh, I played high school football. So.
And it used to be back in, you know, the days we talked about earlier, John Robinson, he would recruit, you know, they'd have 10 tailbacks that would have started anywhere in the country, but they were in the depth, you know, way buried in the depth chart at USC.
Yep. You can't recruit well either. If you're a great player, why would you go to a program that you know is going to be decimated and can't play on TV and can't play in bowl games? You know, you're not going to go there. So, yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing that happens. It's really unfortunate what happens, really, because, you know, Carroll left, all the other coaches left, you know, get away scot free, pretty much. You know,
you say you interviewed Pete Carroll 7 times for the Buggers, sat down with him seven times. I was wondering how different he was in a one-to-one setting than the guy we see on the sideline chomping the gum and all excited, rah-rah.
He's so funny. He goes in waves, kind of. He always would start out kind of mellow, and then he would get hyped up at one point and then come off the crest there. Always moving, of course, always moving around. But I found him to be incredibly insightful, because now I think he's had time to really reflect on a lot of these things. And he was hurt pretty badly. Everyone thought, not everyone, but a lot of people thought that he left. He saw the bad things coming down.
And he's pretty adamant about, like, more than a lot of coaches who say, no, that's not the case. He sounded like, from your interviews, he's pretty pissed about those allegations.
It's his legacy there to some people's eyes, right? So he vehemently denies it. There are other people who say that of course he knew what was going on. Of course he could tell from the questions that the NCAA was asking that they were going to be in, deep doo-doo.
But this was also a different era than it was in the 80s after SMU. Everybody knew that, there are lines you can't cross. So you're not going to try and get away with the same schemes of SMU, for crying out loud. That was nuts. And so you mentioned he had Reggie Bush and Matt Leinart sign affidavits six times a year?
Yep. His compliance guy had that. Yeah. It was sort of like the,
and everybody else is required like once or twice.
Well, but most people do it before a bowl game, right? To kind of qualify that they're amateurs, basically. But their compliance guy had them sign these things, five or six times a year. Again, they're like an honor code at the end of an exam. Basically, you're testifying yourself. It's not notarized or anything like that. That you're.
Yeah, there's two things I really want to attack here as far as the scandals and stuff that USC got themselves into. One was the Reggie Bush whole thing. I mean, you can read about all that and the crazy, players and that whole deal and how nuts it was and how it's like the blind leading the blind. But the other thing, as far as Pete Carroll maintaining it, I don't know if he necessarily maintains innocence, but we didn't really do anything wrong. One of the things was, I'm reading this, I'm like, Paul D, the University of Miami athletic director, is in charge of, or the chair of, the NCAA Committee on Infractions, who investigates USC. Miami's president, Donna Shalala, I believe her name is, comes and talks to either Carroll or some administrator at USC because they have peer reviews. But I'm like, Paul D is the guy? It's like the fox in charge of the hen house here.
It's crazy. I mean, we didn't know that at the time, though, right? It was like not only afterward that it all came out that Paul D was in charge with the AD at Miami when the whole Nevin Shapiro scandal, and he in fact celebrated.
Right, and that happened after the Bush thing.
Yeah. Well, it came out after the Bush thing.
Came
correct?
Out. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So USC fans and players and all sort of have a right to be very angry about the way that whole thing was handled. The Committee on Infractions didn't seem to be on the up and up. They seem, Carroll's right when he says, to a certain degree, for a long, long time, there were competing teams, competing conferences that thought that USC had an unfair advantage because of this celebrity thing that he had, like I said before, because of the fact that Snoop Dogg would give a recruit, a high five.
But UCLA didn't have it. They never did.
Well, UCLA just didn't capitalize on it. They could have had it, I guess, in theory. But so, to a certain degree, there was one player in there who's quoted, and he says, they shut the party down. And that's kind of what they did. It's kind of like they gave them warnings. Hey, calm it down. Chill it out. Don't have these, they did have those open practices, did leave them vulnerable. I mean, it's just, to a certain degree, their greatest strength was this sort of vibe and all the fun they were having, stuff like that, but also became their biggest weakness, right? It did leave them vulnerable to agents coming and all this stuff. I mean, there's one scene in there which I love when the O-line coach comes down after practice one day into Heritage Hall, which is where the football offices are, and there are all these agents in there and waiting to talk to the kids, and he clears the room almost like in the Bible when Jesus clears the temple of the lenders. It's like this great
money lenders. They're out.
Exactly. where he comes in and he's like, I see, he says something like, I know what a cockroach looks like. And then he clears the whole room of all these guys. So, you know, they did leave themselves, and they were warned many times, like, you know, chill it out, calm it down. But, you know, I think at that point it kind of had a life of its own. It was kind of, you know, could spin wherever it went, you know?
So hypothetically, Lendale White, fourth and two, runs 27 power against University of Texas in the potential third national championship game, which I was actually there at the beginning. Well, my friends and I, we've done this thing called the Bowl Odyssey, where we go to all these different bowl games and we get tickets somehow or another. This game was the first one we were willing to pay several hundred dollars a ticket. We just couldn't find one for sale. One of my buddies found one for sale, and we had like seven of us there. And we was like, one guy going, like, where are we going to watch the game? We ended up watching an Outback Steakhouse in Valencia. But regardless, if he gets that extra 6 inches, are we talking about scandals at this point?
It's a great question. I mean, you know, it was the thing that was fun.
Or would the scandals be worse?
Exactly. It was the beginning of the scandal, or as you know, the metaphorical way of saying it, is the Trojan horse had already entered the city walls, right? I mean, it had already begun. Reggie had already started talking to these sports marketers, stuff like that. So it had already begun. What's interesting about that Lendale White play to me, and one of the reasons that I, you know, just loved writing about it, was they were literally six inches away from immortality, right? Three in a row. And again, we go back to the modern era. No one's done that in the modern era. No one.
It was like what Oklahoma, Bud Wilkinson, Oklahoma days or something.
You look back at, like, I think Minnesota, University of Minnesota did it back in the 40s or something like that, right? So, and no one has really come close to doing it since then. And so, you know, if the nose of the ball is just a little bit further, they ice that game. Vince Young never gets the ball back, or if he does, he gets it back with about 10 seconds left, and they win three in a row. And, you know, there's an interesting corollary there too. I think, if you think about that play, the big criticism of that play, it was kind of underthought. There was a linebacker, Texas, named Drew Kelson, who was assigned Reggie Bush. And he's the one who made the sort of big staggering blow on Lendale White.
Because Bush wasn't in the game, right?
And Bush was not on that play. Bush was not in the game. And there's an interesting, the camera pans to him right before Leinert hikes the ball. And he looks perturbed to not be in. And, you know, so if you have him in there, at least he's occupying, put him in motion or something like that. He's occupying that one linebacker who made the play. So you could argue that that play is underthought. Fast forward a couple of years when Carroll's at the Seahawks and he's on the goal line against the Patriots, and they decide to throw the ball, Russell Wilson, end up getting intercepted as opposed to just giving it to Marshawn Lynch. You could actually argue that that play is overthought. And I wonder if there's some kind of connection or some kind of corollary between those two kind of pivotal plays in Carroll's career.
Did you get to ask Pete about that?
I did. You know, he's always been really, you know, the Lendale White play, both plays, he said he'd do it again. And Lendale White in particular, even without Reggie Bush there, that play was averaging 8 yards a carry whenever Lendale got that, you know, that.
I would agree. It's just the execution. Like, the Patriots execution was phenomenal because they knew ahead of time, but also with the, you know, if Marshawn runs up against the line, just like Lendale does, they're out of time.
Yeah. I mean, they had a little more time there. The Patriots had to hike the ball, I think, if I remember. Yeah, they did. They had to hike the ball at the end of that one. But it's so interesting how close, you know, and if you think about Carroll, he kind of had this historical sort of accident of being around at the same time as Bill Belichick, who's considered to be the NFL's greatest coach of all time, and Nick Saban, who's considered to be college football's coach of all time. So he's drowned out a little bit, but he's one of three men to win both a national title and a Super Bowl. He came very close, of course, to winning three national titles and very close to winning in a row, and then very close to winning two Super Bowls in a row. So, you know, he's not probably on the Mount Rushmore of football coaches, but, you know, he's up there. He's top 10, top 12, top 15. You know, you can't really talk about this era of football without talking about Pete Carroll. And he did it in an unorthodox way. I mean, he did it in a totally different way than Saban and Belichick did.
Yeah. And we talked about that Texas USC national title game, which you described in great detail, nice set piece. Same thing with that USC game, or excuse me, Notre Dame game. But with the Bush push game, where you set this up, you know, perfectly. So there's several of these set pieces in this game. So you really get to understand what's going on, not only on the field, but in the minds of the players, the minds of the coaches, even the fans. I think it's really wonderful because there's so many things. So you just watch it on TV. You're like, oh, that was cool. Oh, Reggie Bush is great. But there's so much going on behind the scenes or, you know, that led up to this. And even after the fact, what it meant.
Yeah. I mean, to me as a football nerd, one of the great privileges of this job is I have permission to go ask in detail about these things, you know, like, so it is so, and then, you know, have the privilege of trying to recreate them as well. And like, you know, it's just so fun to ask Pete Carroll, what was going on in the Bush game? What was the call? It was so fun to ask some of the assistant coaches, like, you know, is that a play that you practiced? You know, it's so fun to ask Lindale White, would you run that play again? What did it feel like to not get the, you know, the first down, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I love that. And to a certain degree, I think that Bush game to some of the members of that 2005 USC team was the more meaningful one anyway. Like it's the one that they not more meaningful, but the one that they think back on more, I think. It was such a good game. It's worth a look, you know, go back to YouTube and watch it. It is such a good game.
Yeah, and I was wondering as I was reading this, so you mentioned a lot of the rivalries that USC had, and not traditional rivalries that we may think of, but like Washington State got them, Cal got them, Oregon State got them a couple times. And then, of course, you have this, you know, Fresno State. What I mean, like, oh, okay, Stanford. But like really USC or UCLA and Notre Dame traditionally are USC's big rivals. Where did you come down and saying like, who was USC's biggest rival during this time? Because they dominated everybody. But was it, I say it's probably got to come down to Notre Dame or UCLA, and outlier probably Oregon State. I was at that 2008 game, which was a.
Yeah. I mean, Oregon State beat them twice during this era, which was just amazing. They were actually a pretty good program back then. They had some good DeSean Jackson. They had some great players, but Steven Jackson. They had DeSean too. Didn't they have DeSean as well? Cal, that's right. You know, and Cal beat him with Aaron, or almost beat him with Aaron Rodgers. I mean, they just, what was cool about what Carroll did, you know, he kind of brought a couple things to the Pac-10 at that time, it was called. And he brought defense, right? I remember as a kid checking out 11 o'clock, you turn on, see what's going on in the Pac-10, because it was always nuts. It was no defense, ball slung around, anything like that. He brought to Carroll, you know, it seems like a vibey kind. He almost seems like an offensive coordinator just by his demeanor, but he's a defensive genius. Tutored under Monty Kiffin, who of course is Lane Kiffin's father, who was one of the great defensive minds of, you know, of this generation. And, you know, he brought defense there, but he also raised the level of play so much that other schools had to respond, right? So all of a sudden you had Stanford hiring Jim Harbaugh, and Harbaugh turned that program completely around. You had Oregon getting Chip Kelly. Right. So, I mean, it was kind of like this, the whole thing, it was like this rising tide that lifted all boats. Right. And then what's interesting is when USC went down, I think there's a fine line. You could thread a needle and see the demise of the Pac-12. It became the Pac-12 and the demise of USC. USC was the anchor school in the West. Had USC still been nationally relevant in the last 20 years, which it really hasn't, you know, there's a chance that the Pac-12 might have held on as a conference. Once, you know, USC was out of the picture, everybody kind of seemed to, you know, it was the ebbing tide, right? Everybody seemed to come down a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I loved all that. You know, he really forced these other teams, other programs to really step up or get way left behind in the dust. You know, Saban is sort of the same thing in the SEC, by the way.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think the SEC was also always powerful and had that culture of football around it. But to what we talk about with the SEC now, that is Alabama's doing.
Yep. I mean, a lot of it are, of course, Saban assistants who are doing it, right?
Yeah. You don't talk a ton about Saban necessarily, just other than comparisons, but there are several names you do bring up in the book. One being former USC fullback who was there before Kiffin, Petros Papadakis. And his family had, you know, huge influence. You talk about Mike Riley, I think former assistant at USC. He was the coach at Oregon State. Ed Orgeron, of course, the defensive line coach, recruiting coordinator, becomes a national champion at LSU. And then, of course, Sarkisian and Kiffin. I guess my question is, with all these other names that pop up, was there one guy out of those guys that you either got to interview and really learned to like, or really got to dislike, or both?
Got to dislike? No, I mean, my job is to not kind of like or dislike any, if I can, right? You know, obviously we're humans, right? You there are some people, but I have to say my visit with Lane Kiffin was just absolutely fascinating. So he was still at Ole Miss. He was in Oxford at the time. And, you know, when I got into his office, he had just come back from hot yoga. And, you know, he had a Labrador retriever running in and out of the office that was kind of like his dog that was named Juice, who became part of the program. And, you know, he was particularly insightful, really. I mean, he's such a fascinating, you know, Carroll's first staff at USC was just incredible, right? He had plucked Norm Chow out of BYU. Norm Chow, for those who don't know, was, you know, the offensive coordinator there for a long time, the quarterback coaches. He had coached Jim McMahon, Ty Detmer, Steve Young, like just an offensive genius, right? And working with athletes who weren't necessarily as good as the athletes he had at USC. Right. And Robbie Bosco. I can't forget Robbie Bosco. And then he held on to Carroll. The only real person he held on to from the previous staff was Ed Orgeron, who I think is the best defensive line coach in college football history. If you look at the people he coached, Warren Sapp, Russell Maryland. And then, you know, then he hired these two young guns, right, who weren't much older than the players they were coaching, and Steve Sarkisian and Lane Kiffin. Now, Lane Kiffin was a bit of a nepo hire. I mentioned earlier that, you know, Carroll learned a lot from Monty Kiffin. Monty Kiffin was his mentor.
Well, yeah, and he knew him from the Vikings days, and
even before that. In fact, Pete Carroll babysat Lane Kiffin.
Right, and I, you know, in this whole LSU going to LSU thing, you know, it was famously reported that Kiffin talked to Pete Carroll about what he should do, and you know, who knows how that conversation went, but you know, the fact that they had this relationship, however good or bad it was, it goes back. It's 50 years.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, they called him, they called Lane was his nickname as a toddler was the helicopter. Cause every time he entered a room, he would stir things up, you know, which he is still the helicopter. And it was interesting to talk to Lane about Carroll and about these USC years. I mean, gave me a lot of great insight on some of the play calls and some of the players there, but also just to think about Lane, you know, here's this offensive genius, right? And his three main mentors, this was really interesting to me, are all defensive geniuses, right? His father, Monty Kiffin, obviously, Nick Saban, and Pete Carroll. And, you know, he had this really cool insight on Pete Carroll, which I sort of hinted at before. He was like, if you didn't know that Pete Carroll was a defensive coordinator, you would think he was an offensive coordinator. These other guys are so stern and kind of buttoned up. And here's this freewheeling guy who's going around throwing the ball and trying to kick, you know, balls in practice and all that sort of stuff. You'd think, oh, that guy's an offensive coordinator. You know,
he's throwing the ball like a quarterback. And
yeah, exactly. You're like, that guy's wacky. He's got to be an offensive coordinator. So anyway, Lane's great.
Oh, good. Yeah. So how do you think he'll do at LSU? Do you think that dynamic is going to play in Baton Rouge or?
You know, there's a lot of pressure on him, actually. You know, I think what a lot of people haven't thought about what it means for him, you know, for good reasons, right? I mean, he left a great program. He is yet, you know, he hasn't won anything yet, which is, you know, which is really interesting. He's the hottest coaching commodity in the last 15 years, and he hasn't won anything. So he's got pressure on himself, I think, to perform. You know, he's got Louisiana, for whatever reason. I mean, they grow football players like it's unbelievable. I mean, just locally, if he can lock down the sort of, that's what Nick Saban did when he went to LSU, really locked down Louisiana. And then, when Saban went to Alabama, he started pulling all those guys out of Louisiana, you know? So if he can do that, I think there's an enormous amount of pressure on him. I'm really fascinated to see how all this turns out, you know, cause also he's a marked man now. I mean, he some people didn't like him all that much. I think he's got fan bases that hate him, you know, Tennessee being one of them, and now Ole Miss.
Yeah. Ole Miss is not going to like, my nephew actually goes to Ole Miss. And so it was a pretty interesting time in December there.
It's got to rip your heart out if you're a college kid and you see your coach leave. It's just got to rip your heart out, you know?
Yeah, but anyway, we can get into that later. We got a few minutes left here. You end the book essentially with Pete Carroll in his fishing cabin. And I did not know that he was a trout fisherman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I didn't know that either until I started interviewing him. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you know how he got into that, or just by virtue of living up there in the Northwest?
being in the Northwest, he started becoming like a real trout, you know, trout fisherman. Actually, it's interesting because he's such a kinetic guy who's always moving around. He's a self-diagnosed ADD, you know, sufferer, which, you know, I think is probably not off the mark. But I think, you know, there are certain things that he's done throughout his life and his career that kind of calm him down. One of them is surfing and boogie boarding. But I think, you know, once he got to the Pacific Northwest, there's not a whole lot of surfing up there. So, you know, this was a great way for him to kind of, you know, focus in and calm down and chill out. Yeah. So he loves fish for the rainbow, big rainbow trout up there.
Yeah. And I, you know, and then after the book ends, of course, like it was already published and he gets canned by the Raiders. Have you talked to him since?
I have not. No, I've not. But, you know, it's not surprising. I mean, you know, I was actually a little bit surprised. I think these guys all want one more shot, right? I mean, look at Bill Belichick. They all want, especially those guys, you know, who were really, really good. They're like, I deserve one more shot. And But I was a little surprised he took that job. If you remember in the book, there's a point when Al Davis, Mark Davis, is the current owner's father, is trying to hire Steve Sarkisian.
Right. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Sarkisian was the first guy. And then Kiffin was floppy seconds.
First guy. And then Carol grabs the phone and says, hey, man, you got to look in this guy, Lane Kiffin. And then, you know, Carol has a not very, you know, nice thing to say about the craziness of the Raiders ownership. And it's not like it's gotten any saner. So I'm a little surprised he took that job. And also, you know, it was that roster has to be the worst in the NFL. Like they had two good players.
I was going to say, man, like, you look at the Raiders at times like, man, Pete Carroll took this job. They're going to be so crummy. They got Genty as running back, but really around it, nobody, Max Crosby.
And Brock Bowers. And that's it.
Yeah. Bowers. And then they knock off the Patriots who knows, they might go to the Super Bowl. They knock them off, I think week one or two. And oh man, maybe Pete's got some magic. And then it's a dumpster fire the rest of the season. And like to your point, he had one of the worst rosters, you know, thanks to a lot of these trades and firings and all this stuff for the last 5 years or whatever. And he's left with nothing, but we'll see how that goes. I don't know. All right. Well, this has been awesome, Monty. I appreciate your time. Last thing I want to ask you, just totally unrelated, as a fellow angler, what's your favorite fish or river?
Favorite. So I do a lot of, I can't narrow it down to one favorite fish. I would say tarpon and Atlantic salmon are my favorite two fish. They're one A and one B, and I won't tell you which one's A and B. In terms of rivers, I love the Henry's Fork out in Idaho, but I live in Brooklyn, and so the Catskills are very close to me. And I just love, and there's great history in the Catskills. There's great wild trout. It reminds me of the South. It's got a lot of like, you know, there's like a Japanese knotwood, which looks like a kudzu. And there's like a little hint of kind of redneck menace up there, like moonshiners and distant shotgun reports and stuff like that. So I've always loved, I just love the Catskills. So, but I do a lot of fishing here, believe it or not, here in New York City.
I was reading about that. This fascinates me. I've fished in the Boston Harbor for stripers and bluefish and stuff like that. But I just like the level of dedication that you have for that is off the charts.
Yeah.
But, anyway, it's been great. Maybe we can pick that fishing conversation up another time, but I appreciate your time, Monty.
That's great. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to our conversation with Monty Burke about Men of Troy, the epic afternoons, wild nights, and enduring legacy of Pete Carroll's USC Trojans. And it's one of the most fascinating runs any college program has ever had. So if you enjoyed the episode, please follow the show. Leave a rating or review and share it with another college football fan. And if you're serious about turning your own writing into a business, don't forget to visit O'LearyWriters.com. That'll take you to my Substack Success Blueprint, where I walk you through proven systems to grow from zero subscribers to real revenue with practical step-by-step strategies you can start using today. And that's at O'LearyWriters.com. Thanks again.